Hello and welcome to Banfield. The jailhouse jumpsuit was baggy, and yes, he jangled while he walked. But for a man less than 2 weeks out from being shot in the head and trying to come off a 20-year opioid addiction, take a look at Alex Murdoch, right there. Actually, he didn't look half bad when he entered a low country courtroom today to face charges of trying to hire his own murderer. The motive, which Murdoch's lawyer helpfully explained to the South Carolina magistrate, was money.
This crime involved his attempt to have himself shot so his son could collect insurance money. The only violence he's ever been involved in is this, which was to have himself executed. So he's not a danger to the community. The only person he's a danger to is himself.
Well, that is quite a statement. Spoiler alert here. Alex jangled out of that hearing, a mostly free man, after posting a $20,000 bond. That is, if you consider being an inpatient guy at a drug detox center free, because that's where he has to stay or he'll get arrested. But tomorrow is not going to be much better for the man whose lawyer told the courtroom today is flat broke. Alex is about to be hit with a brand new headache in the form of a brand new lawsuit. It's being filed against him tomorrow over yet another crime victim. All of that coming at you in just a few minutes. But first, we've got some major developments, breaking developments to bring you today in the search for Gabby Petito. She's the 22-year-old who went missing in August while on a cross-country road trip with her fiancé, Brian Laundry. Her last communication with her parents was on August 25th, allegedly from the Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming. Laundry, though, arrived home to Northport, Florida, a week later, driving Gabby's van, but not driving with Gabby. She was nowhere to be seen. He's now lawyered up. He's refused to cooperate with the investigators, but one member of Laundrie's family is now talking. ABC News just posted this interview from Brian's sister, Cassie, about Gabby's disappearance.
Obviously, me and my family want Gabby to be found safe. She's like a sister, and my children love her. And all I want is for her to come home safe and sound, and this to be just a big misunderstanding.
Misunderstanding? I mean, to be clear, this is the very first time that anyone from Brian Laundry's family, including Brian, has spoken publicly about Gabby's disappearance. And you can completely understand how that's something that frustrates the Northport, Florida police who have taken over this case.
Well, we share the frustration with the world right now. So, you know, two people went on a trip, one person returned.
Today, we also got to see for the first time body camera video of an incident involving the police and this couple in Moab, Utah, on August 12th. Gabby accused of hitting Brian in the face. Brian accused of grabbing Gabby's face. Here is a very emotional Gabby talking to the police.
I've decided I am not going to cite you for domestic violence battery, okay? It was only going to be a Class B misdemeanor. However, the domestic violence portion of it enhances it. Makes life a major pain in the butt, especially at your 22, right? So I'm choosing not to cite you today. So you are not going to be charged with it. All right? But this is what I do have to do. I am separating between you tonight. Okay? I want you guys both to be tonight away from each other, relax, breathe, cry, because there's no reason to be crying now, okay?
And we are now just learning about another possible new angle in the case. Police in Moab are actively looking into whether there's a connection between Petito's disappearance and the murders of this couple, newlyweds, Crystal Turner and Kylan Schulte. They were last seen alive in Moab the day after the body cam video of Petito was shot. And Kylan Schulte worked at the grocery store where the fight between Gabby and Brian started. This is a lot to digest. And fortunately, we have News Nation's Brian Enten here to help us sort it all out. He is standing by live outside of Brian Laundrie's house. And Brian, I know you've been there for, gosh, I think it's either 2 or 3 days now, and you've not seen hide nor hair of Brian Laundrie, and he is supposedly in that home. But the police had a press conference there today. Are they calling this a criminal case yet?
They are still not calling this a criminal case, Ashley, and you're right. It is a lot. It's a lot to digest. It's like a puzzle. And the frustrating thing for the police here in Northport is they say the one person they believe could help them figure all this out, Brian Laundrie, still will not talk to them. This is his house behind me. We thought he was in the house. There was activity yesterday, coming and going. The lights were on at night. I'll tell you today, all of that changed. It has been totally quiet. No one has left the house. And tonight, it's totally dark.
So, Brian, it's so curious. What's frustrating about this is when someone goes missing, usually police know where to go. They know where to start looking. But at this point, there's Utah to Wyoming that is chronicled. There's also a trip back to Florida that is chronicled. I don't even know if they've been able to start a grid yet. Do you know?
No, it's a massive search area, and here we are in basically tiny Northport. They're leading the investigation, working as hard as they can. Thankfully, they've partnered up with the FBI, and they've got the authorities in Utah and Wyoming also working on this, but it's just a massive, massive area. We know Gabby's stepdad and family members headed out to Wyoming to start searching, but frankly, they don't even know where to begin.
So, Brian, what about this incident, this moment that we just were looking at, that the police stopping Brian and Gabby? There was a witness that said there was this domestic altercation. Gabby is apoplectic. You just saw the police officer talking to her, but she was also crying through the whole episode. Are they making anything of that here in Northport? Are they suggesting that this might be helpful in the search for Gabby?
Well, they're still just calling this a missing person case, not a criminal investigation. They're keeping the issues somewhat separate. But of course, I mean, this video is really eye-opening to the whole situation. Yesterday, the only videos we had were their YouTube and Instagram videos that made this couple look like they were totally in love and everything was perfect and they were having this incredible journey across the country. Today, the body camera video comes out and it shows that there were some major issues here. You saw Gabby crying. You saw the injuries. And it sort of painted a totally different picture.
Brian Enten standing by for us in Northport outside of Brian Laundrie's home. Thank you for that. I want to pivot for a moment if I can. I'm joined now by two members of Gabby's family. Joe Petito is her father. Zoe Wickman is her cousin. And Mary Wickman is Gabby's aunt. And they are seated beside each other. Joe, if I can just start with you. Any news, anything from the authorities, anything that might advance this case?
No. Nothing that I have. To be honest, I get the information almost as you guys get it. So, no, I don't have anything new. I got some new frustrations based on a statement that was made. But all that comes second because we don't have Gabby, we're still on, job number one, and that's get Gabby. So, we haven't lost focus of that, and that's something we're still spearheading. We got to get her home safe, and we'll look at all the rest of the stuff when that comes to it. Because that stuff was on the 12th, and now we know we had contact with her on the 25th. So that still doesn't help me get to my objective.
And the objective, obviously, is to try to find out anything that might be possible, just in terms of what the last contact her fiance had with her was, and there's just nothing coming from them. To that end, Joe, you and Gabby's mom, combined families now, released a public letter to the Laundrie family, and this is what you wrote. You said, Gabby lived with you for over a year. She was going to be your daughter-in-law. How can you keep her location hidden? Please, if you or your family has any decency left, please tell us where Gabby is located. Tell us if we're even looking in the right place. Joe, the only word that we publicly have heard after that letter came out publicly was Cassie Laundrie, just with that very quick clip that we aired for ABC saying we just wish that she'd come home safely. We loved her, too. How did that land with you?
You know, it actually made a lot of sense. And it brings the things to light because, you know, we've been looking for Gabby for how long? And they've known that Brian's been there since the first. So if she was, so, I mean, that was a very nice, well-written statement, you know. So, but it does explain if that's that family's version of love to just ignore and not care that someone's gone and people are looking for them and the entire country's looking for them. I mean, that explains how we got to where we are today. Because, I mean, look at their version of what they call love. So, I mean,
it's
where was she?
It's just bizarre to see this. I mean, that, you know, just to see no response to this extraordinary letter that you sent out. I want to play one more moment from that body cam video. This is Gabby visibly upset, saying that she needed to calm down. And, you know, it might give some insight as to her state of mind at that time that she had that run-in with the police. Have a look at this.
You want to tell me what's going
on? Yeah, I don't know. It's just some days I have really bad OCD. And okay. I was just cleaning and straightening up the back of the van before, and I was apologizing to him and saying, I'm sorry that I'm so mean, because sometimes I have OCD and sometimes I just get really frustrated. Not, like, mean towards him. I just, like, I guess my vibe is, like, I am like in a bad mood. And I was just saying, I'm sorry if I'm in a bad mood. I've just been really stressed. I had so much work I was doing on my computer this morning.
What do you do for a living?
I used to work at an organic juice bar, but I just quit my job.
Okay.
I was a nutritionist.
That's cool.
And I just quit my job to travel across the country, and I'm trying to start a blog. So I've been building my website, so I've just been really stressed, and he doesn't really believe that I could do any of it. So that's kind of been like a, I don't know, he's like a...
Mary and Zoe, I know that the FBI has asked the family not to discuss Brian and Gabby's relationship. I can understand that there may be reasons that are very important for this investigation. But is that the Gabby that you know in that video?
No, I don't know. I've always known Gabby to just be so kind and caring. She really was just a free-spirited minded. She was always happy. She, like, literally lived in the middle of the desert, and she lived in a tent, and she was still always happy. I've never seen her cry, anything like that.
Stressed out.
Yeah, I've never seen her stressed out like that.
So, Joe, what do you make of that moment that you saw her? Try to just describe for me if that's a completely different person than someone you know who says that she's got, you know, OCD and mental illness.
She likes to have things clean. You can call it OCD or not, whatever you want. It doesn't help me. You know, we can discuss it all we want. If you want to sit here and go back and forth with it, that's fine, you know, but it still doesn't help. That incident was on the 12th. We've spoken to her 2 weeks after that. And now she, and even after that, she's gone. So, again, objective one, you know, is finding her. And then we can figure out all the other stuff that she was trying to talk to in that video. Because I'll tell you, trying to make sure your place is clean, you know, and she liked to have things methodical. And you got to apologize for being in a bad mood when you're in a van, you know, for how many months? Listen, things would get a little testy from time to time. You know, I don't know what happened. I don't know what started it. I wasn't there. I can't tell you. And based on a video from, you know, like that, I can't tell you what it just breaks my heart. I don't want to see it. I didn't want to watch it. You have it up on the screen, so I had to watch it. But now here I am. I'm about to break down. It is what it is. I mean, we still got to focus on finding Gabby. If you could put the 1-800 number for the tip line up there, that would be awesome.
We will. Remind me what it is, Joe, if you have it offhand, and we'll get it up on a graphic for you.
1-800-FBI-TIPS.
Okay, 1-800-FBI-TIPS. We'll continue to remind the viewers about that. In the meantime, is there anything else that any of the three of you would like the viewers to know that might be helpful in trying to find Gabby?
I don't. She's got tattoos. She's got, you know, she's lost. She's hurt, and we got to help her. You know, that beautiful girl right there that you see on your screen, that's her cousin. That's Zoe, and she loved her very much. And we got to bring her home so we can be, you know, a family again.
Well, we'll continue to watch for this. We're putting up that poster right now. It's 1-800-FBI-TIPS. If you've seen Gabby, if you recognize her, if you know anything about this, if you recognize those tattoos, Joe Petito, Zoe Wickman, Mary Wickman, thank you to all three of you. Coming up after the break, is there any way to make Gabby Petito's fiancé tell police where she is? I'll ask my legal expert next. Welcome back to our special coverage of the disappearance of Gabby Petito. She went missing last month while traveling cross-country in a van with her fiancé. He arrived back in Florida on September 1st with the van, but without her. Police have named him a person of interest. I'm joined by attorney Ron Kuby. Ron, you know, the layperson would say, grab that guy by the throat and shake it out of him. Make him answer, where is she and why did you return home alone? Why is that not necessarily something you can really do?
Well, you're not allowed to grab people by the throat and beat them until they talk. I don't need to give a big history, I think, of why you can't grab people by the throat and beat them until they talk. Suffice it to say, that's nothing that the police nor private citizens.
You know, it's a figure of speech. What I'm asking you is, why can't they compel him to try to help find a missing woman? Why can't they say, Brian, you've got to tell us why you came home alone and where you last saw her? Why can't they do that?
Well, they certainly can tell him that. They can't enforce that. You can't be compelled to incriminate yourself. You can't be compelled to speak if you choose not to speak. I mean, that's not a liberal technicality, actually. That's kind of a basic principle of American law going back hundreds of years.
So let me play this moment from the body cam video of the last known video that we have of her, and it's very distressing. She and Brian have been involved in some kind of a domestic altercation. A witness calls the police. They catch up with them down the road, and then this is what they capture on the body cam. And I want to take special note about how tender the police officer is in how he's asking Gabby a question. Take a look.
Gabby, this is a very, very important question. How you answer this question is going to determine what happens next. But the only person who can answer this question is you. Mm-hmm. Think very hard before you answer the question. Do not quickly answer. Think very hard. When you slapped him those times, were you attempting to cause him physical pain or physical impairment? Was that what you were attempting to do? What were you attempting to do? What was the reason behind the slapping and stuff? What was it you were attempting to accomplish by slapping?
I was trying to get him to stop telling me something.
Well, it doesn't sound to me like she attempted to injure him.
So, Ron, it seems as though he's trying to help her help herself. Is that normal?
You know, the police arrive at a scene like that. The boyfriend, the fiancé, he was the one who actually had some injuries. They're in the middle of a camping trip in the middle of nowhere. I think the cops are just trying to sort it out. Nobody's bleeding. Nobody's seriously hurt. And you know, I can imagine being cooped up with somebody in a vehicle for a month and a half. It loses some of the luster it may have had when you were busy posting about van life on the Internet. I don't read much into that either way, except, you know, her statement to the police that she suffers from anxiety and she has some sort of mental illness issues. But I really don't read much into the tape, except we know she and was alive at that point. We know she was alive, we think, on August 25th when she spoke with her mother. And beyond that, we have no idea what happened. I'm certainly willing to say that Mr. Laundrie is not acting like an innocent person. I'm certainly willing to say that an innocent person comes forward and offers assistance and explains what happened. Now, he's claiming that his lawyer told him not to talk. And that's right. I would tell him the same thing. But none of this is consistent with innocence. What usually gets people in trouble.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I've only got a few seconds left. Sorry, we have a delay. I've only got a few seconds left, but there was this issue as well that I needed you to comment on. Two newlyweds were murdered, and their bodies were found in a stream, half naked, within the same week that all this happened in Moab. There seems to be a real connection geographically and with regard to time. And the police are even saying that they're looking into this, possibly in connection. Do you think there's much to be made about the fact, especially for Brian Laundrie's lawyer, to say, look, there was some, their words, creepy guy. These women said creepy guy at their campsite before they were found dead.
Well, it sounds like the making of a criminal defense for Brian, when and if they find the body, when and if he gets charged with murder, he may well be able to blame the lesbian married couple Moab killer.
It's tragic the way they were killed, and still that's unsolved. Ron Kuby, thank you. Appreciate your time. I'm going to switch gears to that other lead story that we're following. A legal name that's appeared on lawsuits and criminal complaints in South Carolina for decades is still showing up on lawsuits and criminal complaints, only now Alex Murdoch is on the receiving end. And the criminal charges that brought him to court this afternoon and the brand new lawsuit that was filed against him yesterday, that's not the end of it by any means. Coming up after this, breaking news of more repercussions, alleged Murdoch misdeeds.
If anyone wants to see the face of what opioid addiction does, you're looking at it.
Well, you actually can be the judge of that yourself, because the face on the left is a former titan of the South Carolina legal system whose defense in his current criminal case rests largely on his 20-year addiction to opioids, he says. And the face on the right is the man he allegedly hired to kill him, who also is said to have been his primary opioid supplier. Both of those men, Alex Murdoch and Curtis Edward Smith, a.k.a. Cousin Eddie, appeared in the very same Lowcountry courtroom today before the very same magistrate over that whole alleged bungled Murdoch scheme to get himself killed for $10 million in insurance money. Murdoch is charged with insurance fraud, conspiracy to commit insurance fraud, and filing a false report. And tonight, he is out on a $20,000 bond that he actually didn't really have to actually post. Bond for Smith, on the other hand, that's the alleged would-be hitman, that was set at $55,000, and he did have to post that. So I want to bring in one of our most trusted resources, WSAV investigative reporter Andrew Davis, who's outside the Hampton County courthouse. And also, in a moment, we're going to speak with Joe McCulloch, who's Connor Cook's attorney. That's going to come up in a moment, though. But first, Andrew Davis, what happened behind you today was nothing short of astounding. We saw Alex Murdoch walk into court, and I dare say looking better than he's ever looked. And he certainly did not have a head wound from a gunshot to the head for which he was life flighted, I think not even 2 weeks ago. And he certainly didn't seem to have the detox tremors for a man who spent allegedly $5 million on opioids. Take me through it.
Yeah, Dick Harpudian really went after it and tried to say, oh, he had a head wound there. But across the board, I was directly behind him, and we all were, and we all looked and said, there's nothing that we can see on his head that is unusual, that even looks to be a former bandage, and his hair wasn't cut in any way. I've never seen an in-and-out wound like that, that you'd have that. And at any point, he's blaming Curtis Smith more than he is his own client. He's focusing on the opioid addiction, claiming that Curtis Smith was a 10-year dealer of his, that Curtis Smith was taking advantage of this situation more than he's actually blaming his client. He's also saying the client is not a flight risk, despite the fact that he had potentially taken millions of dollars from his own law firm and walked out once again without any trouble into a rehab situation. So he's once again spent all of about an hour facing any sort of charges. While they did bring him an actual jumpsuit, which was more than they did for his son 2 years ago involved in that boat crash, we didn't exactly see a lot of people say, absolutely, this is a man who's worried about this or conceding to the fact that he did some very bad things.
Andrew Davis, just sort of a remarkable day, and just a, you know, what a day to be there and to be able to witness it in person, because if you didn't see it for yourself, you might think it's not possibly true. So thank you for that. I want to turn now, if I can, because there is so much more. I want to introduce you to South Carolina Joe McCulloch, if I can. Joe represents an injured party from another chapter in the Murdoch saga. It's the case of that deadly boat crash that killed Mallory Beach. Joe, welcome to the program. This is another, listen, I can't keep up with this case. I can't keep up. Every single day there's a twist. And as it turns out, Alex Murdoch has gone back to his rehab. He's going to transfer rehabs, but no matter which rehab he's in, he's about to find out tomorrow that you are filing suit tomorrow. And it's a suit that says, effectively, and correct me if I'm wrong, you, Alex, were in a conspiracy with others to deflect the blame of your drunk son onto my client, Connor Cook. Is that correct?
Well, actually, I cannot say what the lawsuit will say for legal reasons, ethical reasons. What I can tell you is I was brought into this lawsuit to prevent an injustice. I was brought in by the Cook family because there appeared to be an effort to blame Connor Cook wrongfully to achieve an arrest. We have investigated that. The lawsuit that we'll file tomorrow will be the results of our findings and our beliefs. And that lawsuit will speak for itself.
So usually, I don't think I'm way off base, Joe McCulloch, when you sue someone, it usually has some kind of a financial component. But today, you know, there's your client, Connor Cook. Today, he must have been hearing the same thing that you and I heard, which was the lawyer for Alex Murdoch said, Your Honor, this is not a man of means. He's got nowhere to go. He doesn't have the financial means to be able to travel out of the country. He's even in rehab on insurance, basically saying Alex is flat broke. That can't sound good for Connor, your client here in the pictures. It can't sound good for you, his attorney.
Well, we don't know what his economic status is. And frankly, this suit, while it seeks a money judgment, it's about vindication in of a sort, and the suit will go forward. Those aspects will take care of themselves. There are so many mysteries, so many misleading things that have occurred in this case. It's hard to know what to believe. And
okay, and one
legal
more
process
and one
will
more
tell
mystery.
Us more.
Yeah, one more mystery, and you're going to have to walk me through this one. I do not know how this works, but we all watched at 4 o'clock Eastern as Alex Murdoch, he goes by Alec, even though his name is Alex, as Alex Murdoch was walked into that courtroom today. Okay. And we heard this, you know, robust debate between the prosecutor saying we want $100,000 bond. We want a GPS unit. We want a waiver of extradition so that he will come back out of rehab and come back to be prosecuted. And then we heard the argument on the other side. He's not a man of means. He's broke. He can't travel. Yeah, we'll give you the passport. But you have found evidence to determine that the bond was set 2 hours earlier at $20,000. Like, what was the point of this whole process where he was marched into court if 2 hours earlier they'd already settled on a $20,000 bond?
Well, I wouldn't say that I have found that. I would say that I received information today that at about 2:30, the bond of $10,000 was posted on the public website. Now, that's some kind of anomaly. I was not a witness to that. I can't validate that. I don't know how it occurred. It's just one among many odd, inexplicable things in this case. Equally inexplicable to me, and in looking over the documents as to Mr. Curtis, it charges him with assisted suicide with the obvious intention of the murder of Alec Murdaugh, and yet he is charged not with assault and battery with intent to kill, but with assault and battery of a high and aggravated nature, two very different offenses. And that, to me, is another interesting twist here that, as far as I can tell, with given my experience in the criminal sphere as a prosecutor and defense lawyer, I don't know how you explain that.
Right. Just to be real clear on that bond issue, though, you were presented with some evidence. You don't have to give up your source here, but it was a screen grab of the public website at 2 p.m. that showed $20,000 bond. And when I go to the public website now, you know, at this late hour, it certainly doesn't say that. But there was some, and this was a legal source that had that screen grab, correct?
Someone sent me a screen grab, and I'm not accusing anyone in this court system I don't know. It's inexplicable. I'm looking at something that tells me at 2:35 the bond was already announced on the jail website as having been set, and yet the bond hearing only occurred an hour and a half or there so later.
Later, yeah, that's odd. I don't know how that happens. You wait usually for a debate, and then the judge rules, right? Well, okay, so can I get that mugshot back up on the screen? And just, Joe McCulloch, you and I both know the legal system. We've dealt with, you know, personal injury issues many times, and usually when you have, not that mugshot, Alex Murdoch's mugshot, usually when someone is life-flighted with a head wound that is a skull fracture and an entry and an exit wound, you're going to see something that doesn't look like this. Can you explain this?
No, I can't. I know Alec Murdaugh, and he's very fortunate. And I guess I would say that if I'm going to be shot, I want Mr. Smith to do it. He's obviously not a very good shot and a gentle shooter. But I didn't see any evidence.
I'm still perplexed. I'm perplexed by this because even the shot from behind, like even the pictures from behind him in the court, there's nothing. And he's got short hair. So you would see if there was some gunshot wound to the head, even if it was superficial. There wasn't even a Band-Aid on Mr. Murdoch. Here he is walking in. You can see clear as day, nothing in the front, nothing in the back. So I do not understand how it can be presented to this fine judge, even in that courtroom, that he's got this superficial exit wound, entry wound, and skull fracture. But we're going to leave it for another day, Joe McCulloch. Thank you for being with us. Can you join us later to go through a little bit more of that detail once you do make the filing tomorrow?
I will possibly do that,
okay.
Yes. Thank you.
that's a slight committal. Okay. Well, thank you, Joe. I appreciate it. Coming up after the break, there's, you know, in the land of lawsuits, we're not done yet. Remember the trip and fall? The house maid who died? The settlement for $500,000 that apparently no one in the family saw? Guess what? The attorney for that case is going to join me live next. And apparently we're not talking $500,000. We're talking $2 million. So where is the money? That's next. Welcome back. Almost 3.5 years after longtime Murdoch family housekeeper Gloria Satterfield died, purportedly after tripping over some dogs at the Murdoch residence, South Carolina police are opening a criminal investigation. And Satterfield's sons are suing Alex Murdoch and others over a monetary settlement they say they never saw. I'm joined now by the lead attorney in that case, Eric Bland. Mr. Bland, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I think I was a little astounded when I found out that this headline of the $500,000 lawsuit that had not, you know, not a penny of which had gone to the two children of Gloria Satterfield, it's actually not a $500,000 case. I think you mentioned it's a $2 million case. Can you expand on that?
Yes. First, good evening. Good to see you. Yes. Actually, it's almost at this point $4 million, Ashley. We learned that today from one of the attorneys involved in who's going to be defending the lawsuit this time. And it's just, there's no bottom to this case. If it wasn't so serious, you know, your segment with Mr. McCulloch, you know, what kind of surgeon did he have? Probably the best in the world who can cut his hair, you know, without cutting his hair, fix his head, entry and exit wound. It's just, nothing can be believed. You know, we're all supposed to drink from the same cup of justice, and it doesn't seem to be happening here. But back to your...
This is astounding. So I'm just trying to do some very quick mathematic gymnastics here. If If the suit that we're talking about for Gloria Satterfield was really closer to $4 million and your clients, the Satterfield kids, never saw any of it, and the law firm that the lawyer worked for, PMPED, I've heard of that firm before. That's Alex Murdoch's firm, too. So Corey Fleming, who was representing these kids, is best friend and a college roommate and the godfather of Paul Murdoch and also a colleague at the law firm. I can't imagine any more conflicts of interest there. They got the $177,000 legal fees, but you're saying that there's now close to, $3 million plus that no one's seen. Do you think this is all part of that whole $5 million that have been, absconded with from the law firm? Do you think this is all tied together, Eric?
Yes and no. Let me correct some of your facts. Corey Fleming is not with the Murdoch firm. He is with a separate firm, but he is the best friend of Alec Murdoch, and he was a college roommate, and yes, he is the godfather to Paul. He brought the suit, and it really wasn't a lawsuit. It's claims. There's nothing in the court record that would indicate that there was a lawsuit filed. There's nothing in the court record to indicate that any judge ever approved any settlement. We know that there is at least a $505,000 Lloyd's of London settlement, but Lloyd's of London is known as an excess carrier, an umbrella carrier, above primary coverage. We found out today that there's almost $4 million of total settlements that were reached because Mr. Murdoch had numerous insurance policies. I've never heard in my 33 years of practicing law, a lawyer carrying plaintiffs to another lawyer and saying, I want you to sue me, and then I'm going to admit liability so that we can get a whole bunch of insurance money, and we're going to give it to your clients. Well, everything is true about that, except they never gave the money to the clients. They kept the money. And we have brought a lawsuit against Mr. Murdoch. We brought a lawsuit against, obviously, Mr. Fleming. He breached every duty in the world. And the personal representative was a loan officer at a bank, Chad Westendorf, a Palmetto State Bank. He not only has duties to the estate to marshal all the settlement money when it comes in, but he's an officer of the court. And he has duties to the probate court to account for funds that have to be distributed as per estate law in South Carolina. There is nothing.
Astounding. I want to find out what's going to happen to Corey Fleming. I want to find out what's going to happen to Chad Westendorf. And I definitely want to find out what's going to happen with your clients and the missing $4 million. Eric, you'll have to come back another night. Can we have you back to continue on the story?
I'll be back anytime you want.
Eric Bland joining us live tonight. What a headline. $4 million now in missing money for the Satterfield kids. And I said there's twists and turns. I really mean it. Still to come, the final dominoes in the NXIVM sex cult are now tumbling down. The co-founder of the cult finally sentenced, but the sentence pales in comparison to other leaders. Why? I'm going to ask one of the NXIVM survivors next. Could say they're dropping like flies because the number two in charge at the NXIVM sex cult just found out she's going to spend 42 months in prison. If you do the math, that's 3 years. Sounds long, but if you compare it to the number one, Keith Raniere, who got 120 years, I suppose the question would be, how on earth does she skate? Is she skating? I want to ask a person who was directly affected by people like this, Keith Raniere and Nancy Salzman. Sarah Edmondson was one of their victims. She was branded by Keith Raniere and his cult. Nancy Salzman's insanity, the way she pulled these people in. Sarah Edmondson, when you found out that Nancy Salzman only got 3 years, what did you think?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. Ultimately, similarly with the other sentencing, I felt like I trust the judge and he understands the nuances of the case that, I'm not a lawyer. I think many people from the organization wish she had more, but I think he took a few things into account, including her age, an illness that she's dealing with, and the fact that she did cooperate. Ultimately, she's woken up and recognized that she fell for a con, whereas the other people like Claire and Keith have not admitted any wrongdoing, and I think that's a big difference.
And I'll remind our viewers the names that you're saying. Keith Raniere was at the top, 120 years. Claire Bronfman, financing all of it, got 81 months. Nancy Salzman gets 42 months. Allison Mack, 3 years, and she's reporting for prison early to get those 3 years going. And then Lauren Salzman, time served, plus 5 years. In the letter to the judge, Nancy said this, Sarah. She said, the lawyer said she was fooled, controlled, humiliated, and ultimately led to engage in criminal conduct by an egotistical, self-important sex fiend. Do you believe that?
I do believe that's true, and I think that's partly what he considered when he sentenced her, but I also not sure how much responsibility she's fully taking. I'm just happy that she's awake and recognizes Keith for who he is as a sociopathic con man. That's most important to
me. And I'm sorry for what you've had to go through, but at least I'm glad you're seeing some sense of justice. It's nice to see you again, Sarah. Good luck to you.
Thanks, you too. I'm happy to see closure as well. Thank you.
Yeah. Sarah Edmondson joining us live tonight. And thank you all for joining us as well. It's been nice to have you with us on Banfield. We'll see you right here tomorrow night.